Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM, reporting live from Philadelphia. Our next guest is a graduate of the Stanford University Law School and the current Washington resident fellow for the Middle East Forum, Mr. Matt Mainen. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Doing well. So the last time that we had you on the program, we were throwing some intellectual challenges at you. I think having a little bit of a debate to see how our new fellow was doing in D.C. I think that was back in the fall. But now you've had about 7 or 8 months of well-seasoned analysis. You've written over 10 articles while you've been at the forum, I believe. And you have now come out with a thunderous piece critiquing the new chairwoman or chairperson of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, the former chairperson for the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, Hias. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But first, I thought I'd ask you for your opinions on your recently published piece on annexation and sovereignty and how that fits into the entire debate going on today with the visit, the lightning round visit of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Israel and his meetings with the soon-to-be-sworn-in Defense Minister Benny Gantz, the soon-to-be-sworn-in Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi, and the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Can you give us a little bit of an analysis of what it is that you wrote and called for, and how some of those opinions may have been either reflected with, agreed with, or disagreed with on the ground by Secretary Pompeo today?
Sure. So I wrote an article with a provocative title. It was entitled, "There's No Time to Annex Like the Present." And I laid out a list of reasons why I feel like now was a particularly opportune time for Israel to start annexing the territories. One of which is the world is pretty much still tied down on lockdown and dealing with the coronavirus. The other is there's political considerations in the United States where I don't believe the Democratic Party wants to make Israel a campaign issue, which means at worst, we'll get some sort of message from the Democratic Party. They might even put some lip service about the two-state solution in their party platform. But I think Israel can is in a position where it can annex because I don't see U.S. politics as being able to sufficiently oppose the annexation. I also think there's things going on in Europe right now. I think the EU, people are talking about sanctions, but I think at the end of the day, I just don't see the European Union putting sanctions on Israel.
I want to stop you there just for a second. Let's clarify once and for all, what is annexation and what is sovereignty? Can you give us a quick definition of what you mean by that?
Sure. Annexation is when a country applies its domestic laws onto a foreign territory with the intent to annex. So it's kind of a circular definition.
What area, what land are we talking about when it's specifically the case of Israel annexing territory from the West Bank?
So in the broadest scheme, we are looking at everything that was placed in Trump's peace plan, which is the Jordan Valley in the east of the West Bank, and then the major settlement blocks in the west of the West Bank bordering Jerusalem, and some scattered settlements throughout. So that's what's on the table. The question is, should Israel annex all those parts, or is it wise maybe just to annex a couple parts and decide from there?
Okay, so your definition would be the map that Trump presented between the Bahrain Manama Economic Peace Conference and now what they're calling the Vision for Peace, that land would right now, as of July 1st, which is allowed by the coalition agreement between Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu, become part of Israel proper.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's what's on the table. And the question is if Israel wants to do strategic annexation or do everything at once. Now it's looking like we're not going to find out anything until July. But yeah, the map is the starting point.
Are there any other arguments against besides sanctions from the EU or the potential to upset the apple cart with this becoming a Democratic campaign issue in the 2020 presidential election? That
yeah,
you find to be a particularly cogent argument and then that you would like to address on this interview?
Yeah, well, I think there are two other considerations. One other consideration is the prospects of this causing a major rupture in Israeli politics where the left goes from Zionist agnostic in Israel, as they are now, to straight anti-Zionist. So that there's concerns, and I know Daniel Pipes had these concerns, that this could be the final straw that really causes a rupture in Israeli politics and moves the left away from being Zionist. And I think the other concern, of course, is instability with Intifada, or even instability spilling over into Jordan. So I think those are two both legitimate concerns. I think I would be more concerned about the instability and violence.
So in the same broadsheet, you published No Time to Annex Like the Present on May 10th, and then on May 1st, you publish a widely circulated op-ed entitled Hias Endangers Jews, Empowers Their Enemies. Tell us about that article.
Yeah, so this came about because the Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations has decided to nominate and elect, so she's now their president-elect, the former board chair of Hias, which is years and years ago, it was an organization that helped resettle Jewish refugees after the Holocaust and
For
then resettled.
real quick clarification for our listeners, can you give us a little history on the Conference of Presidents?
Sure. So the Conference of Presidents is sort of an amalgamation of different large Jewish organizations in the United States. So you have the Anti-Defamation League and the Zionist Organization of America. And it also has a bunch of anachronistic organizations that were big, a century ago, but aren't really big players now, like the Workmen's Circle. So it's just kind of a grab bag of organizations that at one time were Jewish oriented. But as we see with the case of Hias, even though it's called the Conference of Presidents of Jewish or major American Jewish organizations, a lot of these organizations really aren't so much connected to Judaism anymore.
Okay, but one would have to posit, I know it's Executive Vice President William Daroff. He is a committed Zionist. He's a former Deputy Director of the Republican Jewish Coalition. He led the Jewish Federations for North America Washington Action Office for the better part of 15 years before he came into this position as CEO of the Conference of Presidents. He's a committed guy. And now you're putting this article out there, which says that Hias endangers Jews and empowers their enemies. What's your fear as it relates to the former Hias chair, Diane Loeb, now becoming chair-elect of the Conference of Presidents?
I think that I have no doubt that that plenty of people, if not the vast majority of people involved with the Conference of Presidents, are very connected to their Judaism and are ardent Zionism, are ardent Zionists. I think the issue is that an organization like Hias has clearly worked against Jewish interests over the past several years. I mean, really going back to the 90s when they switched their priority switched from helping Jews resettle to helping Muslims from Bosnia and various war-torn African countries resettle. And now really the vast majority of populations are resettling are from Muslim countries, which there's nothing wrong with that on the surface. We should be kind to refugees and if possible, do what we can. The issue is that these countries are hotbeds of anti-Semitism. And as we see in Europe, there's been a dramatic increase in anti-Semitic attacks in Europe. And for where we have data for where it's coming from, there's not good data in the United States, but in Europe, we know that a plurality of incidents of anti-Semitic harassment is coming from people from an Islamic background. The issue is Hias, they want to increase immigration from the Muslim world, which is fine, but they're not open to the idea of vetting to ensure that anti-Semites aren't moving into Western countries.
Right, so your issue here is with Hias being part of the Conference of Presidents, not necessarily with the Conference of Presidents itself, correct?
Correct, correct. Yeah, I think Hias really doesn't reflect the values of what a Jewish organization should reflect, which is, among other things, making sure Jews are safe and not, aligning with or aiding people who we have good reason to believe are anti-Semitic.
So, whereas the Conference of Presidents is a public policy promotion organization for what they consider to be, I don't want to say universal, but what a wide segment of organized American Jewry could be considered to be Jewish issues, support for Israel, the fight against anti-Semitism, the fight against the BDS movement. Hayas finds itself, and you say here in this article, organizations like the Conference of Presidents have an ostensible aim of promoting the interests of the Jewish people. An organization such as Hayas, which has played a leading role in threatening these interests, not only has no place in such an umbrella organization, but no room for it in the Jewish community at all. Can you expand upon that conclusion you make in your article?
Yeah, I think, again, it just goes back to the idea that any organization that's actively working against Jewish interests, or if that terminology is not correct, recklessly working against Jewish interests, I don't think anyone at Hayas in their board meetings, I don't think Dayan Lob was saying, you know, what can we do to harm Jews? How can we actively harm Jewish interests? But there was a recklessness in the sense that they had good reason to believe that policies they were promoting were putting Jews in danger. So I think with that level of reckless disregard where Jews are being put at risk, I don't see how that organization can be considered part of the Jewish community.
Understood. Now let's move on for a second to activity in Washington, D.C. You have been in D.C. for the better part of the coronavirus pandemic striking there, but I wanted to get your take on what is the foreign policy establishment in Washington doing during a time where it's virtually impossible for think tanks to meet, for events to be held, for diplomatic engagements to take place. If I read correctly the news release this morning about the Pompeo-Netanyahu meeting, it was the first time that there was an overseas mission from the United States visiting an ally, and it was also the first time that Israel received a diplomat in terms of meetings that were going on there. So what's happening in D.C. now, as it seems as if though the coronavirus pandemic freeze is starting to thaw?
Things are, in terms of foreign policy, things have been moving very, very slowly, if not outright paused. I think a lot of the attention in Washington right now is mostly focused on domestic affairs and the economy. I think really, the only real major foreign policy push we're seeing today is what's going on with Israel, with Pompeo visiting Israel. And then obviously talks about China and how to deal with the coronavirus. But that still seems way down the road and very speculative.
Understood. The issue that I would like to bring up, though, is do you think that this portends to be a long-term threat to U.S. foreign policy interests, specifically in the Middle East and as it deals with Israel, because of this pause that's going on? Are our enemies waiting for us to get back in the game?
I think that it's interesting because I think that there's been some talk. There's an op-ed, I can't remember who wrote it, but it looks like the opposite might be happening. There's been some talk about how Iran's influence in Iraq has been greatly diminishing. So I think even if the United States has sort of paused foreign policy for a bit, there does seem to be good things happening that can be traced back to decisions the Trump administration made before the coronavirus crisis. So I think there's some good money in the bank of good foreign policy decisions made earlier that the United States can still ride out for a while.
Understood. Now, in terms of what's going on in policy making, what are D.C. foreign policy outlets putting on top of the agenda beyond the coronavirus? What are some things that we can expect over the summer? You alluded to this. There's the consequences of the Soleimani assassination, which took place back in the end of December, beginning of January, with the new Iraqi prime minister, who's actually an American ally. There is Iran that's coming down the pike. There's still Syria and Idlib to deal with. What are the top three concerns that foreign policy staff, and both on the Hill and in the executive branch, and also pundits are starting to focus on?
I think it's going to be Iran, Syria, and Israel are going to be the three big issues. It's interesting. Libya is obviously there's a crisis going on there. I think we're in an election year, and I think the real focus is going to be on, I think the big, big, big names are going to come up again and again. And this might be an instance where politics is driving policy. We're going to be hearing a lot about Iran, Israel, and Syria.
And we'll see if there's any October surprise from the Trump administration as it relates to foreign policy. But I really think this is the first time in decades that the primary focus of the upcoming election will be on American domestic politics and not so much our involvement in overseas forays. I mean, it's been, what, 20 years since we've been involved in the, actively involved in the Middle East again? And now this is the first year that it seems as if though there's not major stories coming out of it that affect the U.S., at least in the last few months.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Are we still deployed in these Middle Eastern countries? There's been reports of us taking our forces out of Saudi Arabia. There was two missile batteries, anti-missile batteries that were just moved. There has been threats from the president last week against the Iranian Navy to, I believe he said, blow the ships out of the water if they continue harassing American naval assets after 12 speedboats encircled an American destroyer. What's going on in terms of the deployment of American power in the Middle East?
That I'm not sure about, and I think we're going to hear a lot from the president in the coming months about which direction he wants to take things if he's elected to a second term. I think that there's a lot of things are up in the air right now in terms of U.S. foreign policy related to deployment and military engagements, and I don't think any of us know what direction this is going to go in.
We have sort of a bellwether president. He's been spending so much time focusing on the coronavirus, he may not have had the time to refocus on our foreign policy concerns. Let's shift for a second to the Israel Victory Project, which you are now monitoring and working in concert with Nevet Dromi in Israel in terms of our interests in Washington, D.C. What's the discussion like in D.C. on annexation?
So the big discussion is from an Israel victory perspective is to what extent this enhances Israel victory or to what extent it hurts Israel victory. Because within the Middle East Forum itself, we've been having a nice and very healthy debate that got a lot of praise over the extent to which annexation will help the idea of victory. So my personal opinion is I think that annexation, at least strategically annexing parts, annexing the major settlement blocks, would be a useful tactic to get the Palestinians to realize that their obstructionism needs to end, or they could wake up one day and they're going to have a lot less land than they wanted. So the big debate right now, I think, is does annexation promote the policies of victory, or is it harming victory?
Right, and who's the main opponent to annexation in Washington? I saw Matt Dusk, the former foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, came out with a fiery tweet against an author of an anti-annexation piece by Daniel Pipes. But who else is part of this anti-annexation camp?
Yeah, there's people from the Brookings Institute, the usual suspects. I think, look, I think, I mean, Martin Indyk, who was an ambassador to Israel almost 20 years ago, he's incredibly, incredibly active on Twitter. He seems to get the leftist camp seems to retweet him a lot. So, the usual crowd, basically anyone who was involved with the failed peace talks with the Palestinians, anyone who played a major role, are also spearheading the opposition to annexation. They're saying, hey, let's pretend like we're still living in the year 2000 and let's pursue this. So it really any big name who was involved in the peace talks back then is going to be someone still promoting ideas that are 2 decades old and have 2 decades of proven failure.
Right, but I think there's a big difference here between those who are anti-annexation forever and those who are against annexation right now at this moment. Can you differentiate between the two?
Yeah, I think that I think the one differentiation I would make is a lot of it depends on whether or not Trump wins re-election. Because if Trump wins re-election, I think there are a lot of people in it's a legitimate concern that if Biden is elected president and Israel annexes, what's going to happen come January when Biden's president? So I think that's part of the concern of thinking, why we should wait. If Trump wins re-election, where there's 4 more years for Israel to establish facts on the ground and incorporate parts of the territories into Israel, I think the anxiety people within the victory camp, very pro-Israel, have about Israel annexing would probably be alleviated a bit if come November Trump is re-elected.
It'll guarantee at least 4 more years of American security guarantees and for the situation on the ground to become more realistic rather than the situation as it is right now. But who knows? Trump, as I said beforehand, has been a bellwether president. He might go the opposite way. But it really depends on what happens both in Israeli politics and after the American presidential election. Matt Manin, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think let's just, I think it's important that we keep a really, really close eye on what happens in U.S. domestic politics with respect to annexation. I think in the coming months, we'll have a better idea of whether annexation will be how risky it will be, depending on the extent to which the Democratic Party seems willing to tackle it. I think that if the issue of annexation is not put on the DNC platform, I think that's a sign that they don't want to get involved, and Israel might be able to get away with annexation with a little more ease. So it's going to be interesting. I think we need to keep our eyes on U.S. politics to determine the risks and advantages of annexation, at least until November.
Matthew Manin, Washington resident fellow for the Middle East Forum. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
After these messages, the project directors of